When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 75. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading over to Newport in Shropshire to talk to agricultural engineering lecturer and co-creator of the now world-renowned hands-free hector, Kit Franklin. Kit, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, great to be joining you.
It's good to speak to you. Now, Kit, do you manage to get a break at all this time of year when there's no students at the university, or are you as busy as ever with everything you've got going on there over the summer?
Yeah, well, in theory, I should be able to get away with no students around, but with my particular area of research requiring us to harvest a crop of wheat and barley last year, that doesn't really happen because I have to be here to make that happen. And we've also got all sorts of other projects and things we're working on for the future that we're working on all through this time of year. So yeah, no, it doesn't. The long summer of teachers that everyone imagines that a lecturer gets doesn't happen for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, and how's the wheat looking? Is it very far off?
I think we could cut it tomorrow, really. Yeah. It's obviously rained a bit the last couple of days, but it would cut. We're holding fire for two more weeks. We've set a date because we've got all sorts of film crews and journalists who want to come and see it. So we have to put a date in the diary, which last year was an absolute nightmare, what with the weather. But this year, we're hoping, should be safe bet this year.
So,
14th of August is the date.
Okay. But, all right, then. So, Kit, have you heard of the AFTP, the Agri-Food Training Partnership?
I haven't, no.
Well, it is a partnership, actually, between six leading UK universities, one of them which is your employer, and it's the bridge.
Brilliant.
And the bridge between industry and academia, translating cutting-edge academic research into applied industry expertise. Starting this September 2018, you, Kit, or listeners, could be doing online part-time courses in subjects as interesting and diverse as grassland systems, ruminant health and welfare, ruminant nutrition, agro-ecosystem services, soil management, or water and agriculture. And you will know just how important and relevant they are right now, Kit. You can find all these courses on www.aftp.co.uk/podcast and mention the word podcast when booking for a whopping 10% discount on the catchily titled course, Livestock, Livelihoods and Food Security. Food security, of course, being mentioned every day in the UK press right now, it seems. The course provides an in-depth overview of the livelihoods and food security issues deriving from farmed livestock across a global range of production systems. Once again, that is www.aftp.co.uk/podcast. Mention the word podcast for a 10% discount. Right then, Kit, you are now, as we've established, a lecturer at the greatest university in the world, Harper Adams, but you're actually from near Cirencester, the other place. Clearly, you've moved in the right direction.
Yeah. So, family farm, literally 10 minutes to the Royal.
Yeah.
I got married 6 weeks ago to my now wife, who's at her parents' house, which is about 5 minutes from the Royal.
Wow,
so, yeah,
okay.
Literally next to some of the land of the Royal. But yeah,
wow.
Came away, well, 10 years and ago now, came up to Shropshire to study at Harper.
Okay. So farmer's son then?
Yeah, small farm. My dad actually did the classic diversification, became a builder basically.
Okay.
So yeah, small farm at home that he ran on the weekends, and he's a builder, had a big company when I was growing up, did schools and post offices and all sorts of stuff.
Wow.
Now sort of scale back and does extensions and barn conversions and things. But yeah, so small farm. But then my two older brothers did want to be farmers, so they set up as contractors. So yeah, so farming's the major part of my background.
Yeah, okay. Do you get back down there to help out much at all?
Not really.
Too busy, I guess.
I try and do weekend or so mm-hmm. every summer. So I've not been back. I'm back this weekend coming. Normally end up sat on a baler or sat on a corn cart for a day or two.
Yeah.
Keep my toe in.
Yeah. So obviously that's where your interest in both agricultural and engineering comes from then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically growing up, farming itself didn't really interest me, or to be honest, probably my brothers. We loved kit, we all loved machinery, mm-hmm. and the farming was just an excuse for using some machinery. I think we've all probably changed as we've grown up and got more and more interested in the farming. But, as kids, it was, and growing up, it was all about big machines, really. And especially, bear in mind, my dad was in construction, so not just farm machinery, we've got diggers and dumpers and whatever else around the farm as well. So, lots of big boys' toys.
Yeah. Growing up, were you one of those annoying kids who was forever taking things apart and putting them back together again, like your mum's Hoover and things?
No, I don't think like my mum's Hoover and things, but I had to, certainly, summer holidays were push biking and fixing bikes and making go-karts and building dens and all those things, classic farm background. And, bought my own tractor when I was 12 years old sort of thing. Wow. And, then went and did some bits of stuff around the farm, a bit of topping or whatever on my wrecked old Fiat tractor. So, that was sort of. That was sort of some holidays and things.
Yeah. So when did you start to think about agricultural engineering as a career?
I guess basically at school, I wanted to be an architect. That was my first thing. I liked design. I liked the idea of drawing things and then being made. So the first thing I guess you're exposed to in that is architecture. Yeah. Sort of things on TV, what with grand designs and things like that, I guess. So. Yeah, architect was in the front of my mind. I was quite good at maths and science and things. And then, I don't know really. I think it was my eldest brother, one of his friends, a chap called Ryan Hudson, who's an agronomist, fairly well known. He came up to Harper. Mm-hmm. So obviously Harper suddenly came on the radar. Mm-hmm. My brother's 7 years older than me. And so, Harper came on the radar. There was this course called agricultural engineering. It was all about designing and developing machines for farming, and I was about, I don't know, I guess I was 14 or something like that, mm-hmm. and that sounded like best job in the world. So so I was marketed to at a very young age somehow. Yeah. But when I heard this subject existed and this job existed, it just sounded perfect.
Yeah.
So I designed things that were machines that I found interesting.
Yeah.
So, that was the end of architecture.
and choosing to study at Harper Adams, in hindsight now, that was a pretty important decision.
Yeah, I mean, huge decision. I mean, I knew early on, so it made me decide what A-levels I was going to do. I chose A-levels to be the right ones to come up here and do it. Mm-hmm. So, everything was then to come here and then just to get out the end. And at first, you'll know, being ex-Harper yourself, that obviously JCB have got quite a big influence at Harper and take quite a lot of our students.
Yeah.
And that's always been a thing. So my original aim was to come, do 5 years, get my master's and go and work for JCB. That was the plan when I was probably 16.
Okay.
Things changed a bit. But that was the dream.
Yeah, okay. So tell us about your time there then. I mean, you gained a hell of a lot of practical experience in a real range of subjects, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, so agricultural engineering, for anyone who doesn't know or doesn't quite realise what it covers, it's from anything from drainage and irrigation, so kind of civil-type engineering.
Yeah.
All the way through mechanical, hydraulic, developing machines, and then of course these days more and more electronics. So every machine that's sold now will have an element of electronics on it. Even the most basic machines will have some sort of camera system or sensor feedback system. So it's a hugely broad subject. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I was sucked in because I wanted to design big bits of metalwork, really. Mm-hmm. And that's what I took. I came, and that's what I did. I did a placement year at Lightrack Crop Sprayers, which a very large crop sprayer mm-hmm. produced over near Peterborough. So I went and worked for them as a design engineer for a year. So again, designing big steel, big machines,
yeah.
Which was great. Small company as well. So I did all sorts of extra bits there. I did bits of marketing and going to the shows and talking to people on bit of a salesman and all the things. That was a good experience.
Yeah.
I even ended up at one point I worked for AGCO for a summer. So I went and was a test engineer for AGCO over in France.
Wow.
So combine developed in America. That was my dream job. I absolutely love combine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't get it. Any of my students know, don't get me started on combines. I just love them. But so I worked for AGCO. It was an American design combine. They were trying to review it for use in Europe. So,
yeah.
And they needed an extra pair of cheap hands. So that was me. So I was out chasing combines around fields, doing loss monitoring and things for a summer.
Yeah.
Which is great. But but basically the reason then I ended up not going and being a design person and doing these things is because as I went through Harper, I realized that I gained a love and appreciation more and more for actual crop production mm-hmm. and why these big machines were important. So, I had friends who were studying straight ag, and, you know, we'd sit down and, you know, obviously as you do over a beer, talk about all the things that, you know, are important, you know, be it, compaction and soil and those sorts of things that were topics of the day and cover crops and was it all lies and was it real science or people just made it up. And more and more kind of got interested in the crop, actual growing crops and how that works. And I'm not an agronomist, I am an engineer, so I'm not the best at all that, but that, you know, the whole why are we making these machines became more and more important to me, and not just making machines.
And when did your interest in robotics start to develop?
Yeah, so that was in my final year. So I did a 5 years master's. So in my very final year, I worked closely with the then head of department mm-hmm. in engineering, which was Professor Simon Blackmore, and he's like world renowned agricultural robotics sort of. He came up with a lot of the theories and the ideas of why robotics might be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, at first, me and my colleagues didn't really believe in a lot of it. We sort of we'd go to, you know, bear in mind there was about six in our year, so our lectures tended to be in his office and we just sit around and discuss these ideas and throw them around and whatever. And but just some of the ideas he was talking about started to resonate, started to click and make sense. Me and Simon don't agree on everything in terms of agricultural robotics, but the ideas that he'd come up with them and he goes around the world talking about still to this day, resonated. This idea that autonomous machines could be a lot smaller because you didn't need someone sat on them driving them.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd be better for the soil and they could be, you know, infinitely more precise because you could be, you have lots of tiny machines that treat each plant as an individual. So we can put less chemicals into the environment and we can, A, just cut the use that, you know, so in theory we can cut the chemical bill, but we can also be better for the environment at the same time.
Yeah.
So it seems that a lot of the problems that, as I say, I was discussing over a beer with my agric friends were being answered by these theories behind a revolution of small, tiny robotic machines. So yeah, and as I say, at first I didn't believe it all and sort of, you know, I guess me and my mates all sort of fought against it, if you like, and debated it and discussed it. But yeah, some of it made sense. And then we ended up, in that final year, we made a robot, which was the first robot made at Harper Adams. And now we've obviously got a bit of a track record. But me and two colleagues, so James Thomas, who now works at Syngenta, and Chris White, who's now an engineer at JCB, he did the Harper Dream.
Yeah.
the three of us made a robot called Dionysus, and that got us into the Farmers Weekly, and it got us on into the iAgri magazine, which is the Institute of Agricultural Engineers. So, you know, we did this thing. We had a robot. It drove around a rugby pitch. It was all right. It didn't really do much, mm-hmm. but the ideas behind it generated a bit of publicity, and it was all quite interesting, really.
Yeah. Okay. So after graduating, then you got involved a little bit more, a bit of travelling to Vietnam and Japan.
Yeah. So just a classic thing, worked pretty hard in my master's year. We built a robot. I did a thesis, of my own, all about control systems for PTO power harrowers. So I was monitoring torque in the power harrow in the transmission of a power harrow, and then basically changing how you would drive to make different tillage effects. So, I did some pretty chewy stuff for a year, and therefore at the end of it, just needed to kind of do the classic flake out. But not completely just gap yearing. I thought, I had an idea that these things called paddy fields might be interesting to look at. So I went to Vietnam, and my brother actually came with me. So yeah, my brother George, my middle brother, came with me, and we hired motorbikes and we rode around Vietnam, basically finding paddy fields, which there's quite a lot of, but there's all sorts of different types. You've got massive in the south of Vietnam, you've got huge plains, a bit like being over in the Fens or something. As far as the eye can see, you've got paddy fields, and then as you get nearer the north, it turns into mountains, and they're all terraced up the side of a mountain. And obviously the technology therefore changes immensely. So down the bottom, down the south, it's all hugely mechanized, and they export a huge amount of rice, and some of the rice that we eat comes from the supermarket will have found its way from South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So whereas in the north, it was kind of more subsistence, still a lot of animals being used, and a lot of oxen and stuff being used for draft tillage and stuff. So, did that. And then from Vietnam, which, that was an experience in itself, riding around on mopeds. A good little anecdote. One of the best ones is we broke down. My bike broke down up in the middle of a mountain somewhere, and sort of we towed it with the other bike, from brothers on one bike, dad on the other. He towed me into the local village, where we gave it to this mechanic to fix. So we're on cub Honda Cub motorbikes, and they're everywhere, and everyone knows how to fix them in theory. So you give them to this chap, and it turns out that he fixed it and it started. However, about an hour down the road, it pulled over and it was in the rain, and there was a huge slick of oil under the bike. It turned out he sheared off one of the head bolts. There's four head bolts, and it's only a tiny little piston, so he didn't need them all. But rather than telling me he'd done this or trying to fix it properly, he just hammered a chopstick into the hole. Sure enough, an hour later, the oil pressure would push this chopstick out, and the oil was just pouring out of the bike. We had to go to another town and fix it by chucking a load of, to be honest, just a slightly more advanced bodge, where we covered the chopstick in silicone and hammered that back in the hole and let the silicone go off a bit. And it seemed to work from then on. But that was good fun. But so we went from Vietnam, which was all a bit, interesting. Yeah. And we went then straight to Japan for a week, sort of see very much the other end, where it's obviously, as you imagine, everything's very high tech, including went to Kyoto University, where they've got a robotic combine. So they've got, I don't know if you've ever seen a paddy combine, but they're tiny, they're on tracks. They're sort of the size of, I guess, a hatchback car. So they're on tracks. And they made one of those robotics. It was a student project there for a few years. And so we went there and saw that and saw the sort of systems being used. Really, really clever stuff, as you'd imagine. So, all a bit interesting, eye-opening stuff, seeing different parts of the world and all that.
Yeah.
And then, sort of came home, really. Basically graduated, did some work, paid for a bit of a trip around the world, or a bit of the world, and then came home and had to look for a job. So, that was where the sort of then, I had no life plan, certainly, to become what I became. Yeah. But basically, I ended up with a couple of choices. So there was two, I won't say the companies and what they were, but there were two very much engineering jobs. And then there was this there was research starting to happen in the engineering department at Harper under the AgriTech funding. So interesting sort of projects to do with. One was bale logistics, so making a clever system for picking up bales in a CTF field. Which I think has now just been released. I can probably say who that was now. So, Big Bale South, who make the Transstacker.
Yeah, okay.
For picking up large bales.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did some work for them, making it load itself automatically, basically. So I did all the mechanical part of this loading system, and then my colleague John made it all electronic. So there was these couple of projects, and basically it was like I could go to work for a couple of big companies and be an engineer, or I could come to Harper where I thought every day would be a different day. I'd probably meet some random people over time, and I thought, something might happen here that's a bit interesting. So by the time I sort of left Harper, I'd sort of also developed a bit of a complex that I wanted to change the world. I don't really know why, but I decided that I just didn't want to be a design engineer. I wanted to sort of change something. I wanted to make a bit of a difference. Help the world feed itself or whatever. So yeah, I thought that coming back to Harper was the best way I might make a difference. Really.
Okay. So what does your current job involve, and what are your areas of responsibility there?
Okay. So my current job is not what I started off doing. I mean, I came in literally as a researcher. So now I was a graduate engineer, and I came and basically did designed metal work for projects that were cleverer than that. And then 18 months in, a position came available for an agricultural engineering lecturer. So I guess quite, probably a bit above my station, but I put an application in. I thought, move things forward.
Yeah.
So I managed to get that. So basically became employed as a lecturer. So it really, that means that at that point, I essentially 100% of my time at that point would then change from, obviously I was research, 100% of my time then changed to being student oriented, so lecturing, so teaching students mechanical engineering, so how to design machines, and then also agricultural engineering subjects. So I do things that are my sort of area, be it combine design and also obviously robotics and things like that.
Do you enjoy working with the students? You must do, I guess. It's a huge part of your job.
Yeah. So it was, the moving into being a lecturer was a way of essentially getting a bit more money, a bit more security in the job. And also, and you can do research as well. Once you get into that position, you can start to run your own research rather than before I was just doing other people's research.
Okay.
So there were sort of those reasons, but also I did always love, even as a researcher, I did always love the brief bits of student interaction I did.
Yeah.
So if a student comes and finds you, even in the role I was doing, you'd occasionally, a lecturer would send a student to come and talk to me because they thought I was the right person to talk to about a certain subject. And that sort of light bulb moment that I guess, teachers talk about, it's brilliant. Yeah, when someone comes into my office with a bit of a query, you draw some pictures on the whiteboard and you wave my arms around a bit and talk a bit and maybe pull a book off the shelf and flick to a page and go, have a look at that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's that sort of seeing an idea spark in someone's eye is brilliant. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And just trying to engage people, because I absolutely love my subject. Mm. So absolutely love what I do, and standing in front of a room and just enthusing about something is good fun, really.
Yeah.
So the being a lecturer is great, but equally, I always, as I say, wanted to change the world, and now I have lots of colleagues who would say that they change the world by inspiring people who then go and do clever things.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of needed some self derived. Changing the world, to sort of fulfill myself, really. So
yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah, that was obviously why we got into other things. But really, when I started, as a lecturer, when I became a lecturer, my job was just student oriented, really.
Okay, so it leads us nicely onto hands-free Hector then. What is it, first of all, especially for those people listening who might not be from the UK, what is it, and how did it first come about?
Okay, so in the simplest term, it's a hectare of crop that is grown without ever anybody going in the field. Mm-hmm. So we do all the operations, all the work with tractors and combines is all done by autonomous tractors and combines. But as well as that, nobody goes in the field to do the agronomy. So no crop doctoring happens in the field, as I say to people. So we do all the agronomy from drone information, so photos and multispectral images and things like that.
Okay.
And we also send things into the field and retrieve samples and things like that. So we can look at the crop, but we never no one goes inside the field. It's completely hands-free. And the idea was basically to move the conversation of agricultural robotics on, as I kind of alluded to earlier. I believed in a lot of the ideas of agricultural robotics, this idea that small, smart machines could potentially be better for the environment, better for yields, and ultimately better for the back pocket of farmers.
Yeah.
I sort of believed those ideas. But the ideas were being talked around. They'd been talked about for 15 or so years, but no one had really done anything. Mm-hmm. The robot I built as a student drove around the rugby pitch. And if you go on YouTube, there's lots and lots of ag bots and robot tractors that are out there driving around rugby pitches, yeah, or equivalent. And basically it was this idea that let's make a robot, but actually go farming with it. Now, at this point, I have to mention, say, my colleague Jonathan Gill, who I basically said about earlier, who basically is a robotics engineer, okay, and a drone developer. So he was a researcher. His main focus was on drones and how they can be used in agriculture.
Okay.
But basically, these drones are mega reliable in the sense that they come out of the box, you type in some waypoints into an app on the iPad or whatever, and off they go, they fly point to point to point, and they land back at your feet, and they're really reliable, and they're really cheap as well. In the context of robotics, they're cheap.
Yeah,
they cost £1,000 or so.
Yeah.
So, whereas every agricultural robot that I'd ever seen, ever come across, ever worked on, cost tenfold that, in the hundreds of thousands of pounds to create a robot, and then generally they don't work very much. They tend to be very temperamental.
Yeah.
So the idea basically came from the two of us over the course of, we worked together for 2 years, but I guess it was over 6 months this idea formed. But could we use that really reliable and really cheap drone technology, put it into a tractor, and then have a really cheap, reliable robot tractor? And could that tractor then go farming and therefore move this conversation along that had got a bit stuck? People talking about it, but not actually doing it.
Yeah.
So that was the grand ambition, was really to say, do a world's first, but all just to move the conversation around agricultural robotics forward.
Who came up with the name Hands Free Hector?
Now, I couldn't remember. I remember the conversation.
Yeah.
We were sat there talking about, right, we're going to do this thing. It's going to be a hectare. We're going to grow a hectare of crop with a tractor, yeah, blah, 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 and we need a snappy title.
Yeah.
So, and I remember the conversation, but I can't remember who said it. But John told me the other day he thinks it was me, but I'm not even 100% sure of that. But we came up with it. Apparently, yeah, I came up with it. He came up with it. Whoever came up with it, we wrote it on a post-it note. This is the sort of story that's kind of gone down in legend or a little bit.
Yeah.
So we wrote the Hands Free Hectare on a big post-it note, stuck it on the wall. And that was about 6 months before I became a lecturer.
Okay.
And there this post-it note sat for getting on for a year. No one ever questioned it. All of our colleagues, superiors who would visit our office would ignore this post-it note. No one ever asked what it was. But with time, we sort of did more and more sort of work secretly on what this project would be. Because we kind of knew that we'd be shot down if we ever told anyone, because everyone knows that agricultural robotics is really expensive and there's no way that we could do it for cheap, and there's no way that we'd be able to grow a crop and it would all be too risky and all these things. Yeah. And so we kind of developed the idea pretty much in secret, really. Okay. We only told sort of one colleague who was our business development manager. We told him about it, Lee. So he knew, and he thought it was quite a clever idea and sort of gave us a bit of support in creating this project. And then we found out about, you know, basically all these things that we do, all these research projects are funded by various councils and research bodies. And one of them is a thing called Innovate UK,
okay,
which is a UK government funding body that funds collaboration. So the key is they want companies to work together.
Okay. Because
when you collaborate, you get more done, yeah, basically. So this funding was out there to do, it was the specific funding we went for was a thing that was called Satellites for Agri-Food. So it's how can satellites help farming, basically.
Yeah.
So our technology is all based on GPS. So we fell into this funding call, but we needed someone that would go in with us. So, and that's where we then, you know, again, it comes back to my statement about I went to Harper because I thought I'd meet the right people.
Yeah.
Well, one of the people I'd met time and time again in the sort of couple of years I'd been working at Harper was Clive Blacker, who's director at Precision Decisions, who's a big, or, you know, fairly big precision farming company, yeah, up in York. So they've been helping people adopt precision farming technology since the early 2000s. And Clive's a really sort of pushy chap, you know, wants to stir things up, mm-hmm, not afraid to say the wrong thing at the right time or whatever. So we basically approached Clive and said, look, we've got this idea, I know you like stirring things up, do you want to sort of stir stuff up with us? And so Clive said, yeah, he was up for it, and he'd come in as our sort of commercial partner.
Okay.
So again, that, you know, we kept developing this project. So you know, sort of in a sense it's a 50-50 collaboration between the two of us. Financially, actually, it's more Clive's project than it is Harper's. Mm. More PD than Harper, but you know, the agreement was we'd do this all 50-50 and try and split all the any praise. But from day one, what made it very different was that we were going to telegraph about it.
Yeah. Okay.
So most pieces of research, academic research, happens in a lab and then someone writes a paper and then somebody maybe reads the paper. Commercial research happens in secret, and if it goes wrong, you definitely don't tell anyone. And if it goes right, you make a product and you sell it for lots of money.
Yeah, okay.
Now we said, well, we didn't want to do either of those things. The whole point was we wanted to make a big scene. We wanted to show people farming with robotic machines was possible. Mm-hmm. So that was why we needed the snappy title. And that was why we were going to share all this stuff using social media and all those things. But so that was all sort of set up, but then we still needed to submit it. So eventually I actually had to tell someone at work that I was going to do this.
Yeah.
Because I can't just, you know, you can't just submit a funding bid with Harper Adams written on it without one of the bosses knowing about it. So,
yeah.
Eventually, I got called into to the Deputy Vice Chancellor's office, and he sort of said to me, "We know you're working on something. We know you're doing something. You know, what is it? What is this thing you're working on?" So I said, "Well, it's this thing called Hans Reactor. We're gonna grow a crop. We're only gonna use robots, and we're gonna do it all using drone stuff, and it's gonna cost £200,000."
Mm-hmm.
To which I was told, "You won't, because it costs more than that. We've been making robots for the last 5 years. We know how much they cost. They're lots of money and they don't really work very well. So you're not doing it."
Okay.
And so then I did, after 10 minutes or maybe half an hour of conversation, and I think, as I said, at Oxford, smiling,
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah.
I managed to get him round to agreeing that we could submit this proposal. Which we did, which was lucky because it came through. I think the famous line is, I'll get shot for sharing this now, was, you know, what if it all goes wrong? We'd all look like idiots. And I just turned around and said, well, what if it goes right? We'll all look brilliant, won't we?
Yeah. Okay. So what were the at that point then? What were the? You've mentioned the drone technology and why that was so important in keeping the cost down. But what kind of costs were you looking at? Because that's the thing, isn't it? You there is this perception that this stuff is going to cost a fortune. Well, that was the difference between your system, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, the project as a whole, I mean, these are all figures that anyone can go and find if you do enough looking on the internet. So project as a whole cost £200,000.
Yeah.
But obviously there's a lot of people's time in that. There was, a year's time for Jonathan, my colleague. There was, a couple of days a week for me. And then Clive took on an employee, so that's Martin Abel. If you look into any of the stories, Martin was employed by Prisons and Decisions just for this project. So a lot of that cost is essentially pay and wages, and the overheads that come with that. But in terms of the actual technology, the equipment that, the electronics that we put onto our tractor that makes it the robot costs around about £10,000.
Wow.
So. And a lot of that is RTK, so high precision GPS that gets us 20 plus or minus 2 centimeters. That is a lot of money's worth. But if you strip that out of it and just went to basic GPS using this drone technology to drive your tractor, it wouldn't drive very straight, but or very precisely, but it would be a sort of 5 or 6, there's probably about £6,000. £4,000 worth of it is an RTK system, which you just can't get for any cheaper.
Yeah. Okay.
So, although ours is cheaper than Lock, it's a sort of prototype system that's from China actually. So what we did isn't yet sort of feasible for the average farmer, but for the average person who's got a bit of an idea with electronics, it's not beyond doing. It's essentially John and Martin, the two of them, made all these systems in a year using off-the-shelf components. Some of it came from quite far afield, but bolting all these components together, lots of little random pieces of electronics from eBay and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah.
That go together to make a tractor drive itself.
Just to be clear, you put this stuff on a relatively old combine, didn't you? It's not as if you built a machine from scratch. It's all added.
So that was the other thing that kept the cost down. Which I've not said there is that most people who'd made agricultural robotics robots had started from scratch.
Yeah,
they'd gone and they developed a machine from scratch and then developed a load of software and then developed a load of electronics and bolted it all together, and sure enough cost a lot of money and is really unreliable. Whereas we said, right, let's use stuff that works. So the tractor is an off-the-shelf compact tractor. It's a little IZQ. We just took a machine that works reliably, added some electronics to it, now it drives itself. The combine is a Sampo from around about 1990 ish we think. That cost us £10,000. It was essentially destined for the scrap heap when we took it on, and we turned it into a robot. So, what we do basically is, so the stuff that comes from the drone is essentially a brain, a computer processor, so which is based on a mobile phone anyway. So mobile phones were developed into flying machines that we call drones, and then we've taken that and stuck it in a tractor. So small piece of electronics, and that's doing the I'm in one place, I need to go to another place, what do I do to get there? I turn left, I turn right, I go forwards, I go backwards. So that's what the drone bit does.
Okay.
And then we interface that with a load of electronic mechanical electronic components like motors and actuators, so linear actuators like you might get in the back of a combine, or you might get to move a bed in hospital, so an electric bed in hospital or whatever, have got these components on them. And then we basically take those components, motors and actuators, and bolt them to the hand controls in the tractor. So again, if you watch any of the videos, you can see the steering wheel move and you can see the foot pedals move.
Yeah.
Because all we've done is taken a person off and put these electromechanical parts in their place.
What were some of the biggest unexpected challenges you faced?
To be honest, finding the combine was a bit already mentioned that about rice combines earlier. I we were I really wanted to use a paddy combine, these tiny combines from Asia that were brand new, but basically we just couldn't get one into the country because of CE marking. So we had lots of companies actually offer us their combines. Mm-hmm. But then when it pushed came to shove, they realised that they weren't basically legal in the UK, and that was going to be an issue. So we had a tractor. We built a tractor from December till and in January, we were midway through building the tractor, and that was all going to be fine. But we didn't have a clue where the combine was going to come from. So there was a real chance that we'd have our barley in the ground growing, but nothing to cut it with when it got to harvest. So that got quite stressful. and we couldn't afford, bearing in mind, so our combine is a trials combine, so a plot combine, but we didn't have the budget to buy a brand new plot combine. They had lots of money because they're very clever bits of kit. And basically, eventually, we tracked this one down that was very old and not worth a lot of money, thank goodness, because otherwise, we would have looked a bit silly if we got to harvest and we didn't have a combine. So and obviously the whole point was we were trying to use small, compact machinery, which is then, it's sort of safer for us because, going and automating a blooming great, 30-foot-wide cutter, Lexan, or something, would be absolutely lethal.
Yeah.
So, safety is a big thing. Uh-huh. It's a small thing. It makes us use small things. But also, this idea that we're trying to be kinder to the soil, and these really big machines aren't very good for that. Mm. So, we struggled with the combine, but and then more technical than that, we making the tractor drive in a straight line. So if you watch the videos of it drilling first year, it's really not very straight. I mean, a drunk could drive straighter than our tractor did the first year.
Yeah.
But the point was it did it. We managed to put a tractor in a field with no one sat on it, and it drilled a field. Now, it wasn't the best drilled field in the world. There was lots of misses, and it wasn't very straight, but we did it. And then with time, and a lot of time, we managed to improve and tune the system. So Jonathan and Martin spent days tuning our system to enable it to drive straighter and straighter. And now this year, we've changed some of the hardware. It's slightly different the way it works. But this year, if you look at the footage we've got, it's, the tractor drives as straight as any commercial system now, actually. Any commercial sort of auto steer. So, but it just took a long time, longer than we thought to get that tuning right, really.
I've seen the footage, and it's a for obvious reasons you picked a flat square field. Going forward, obviously not many fields are like that in this country. I guess as you, I've got one field that's got six oak trees in it. The technology improves, awareness systems, things like that, which gets talked about a lot these days, it will be relatively easy to overcome those challenges.
Yeah, I mean, again, we chose square flat field because we had very limited time, and we just need to make some things easy for ourselves. We made a big enough challenge as it was. So, but a commercial auto steer can cope with banks.
Yeah.
So there's no reason that any system in future won't be able to cope with banks because it's just the same sort of algorithm. And then, the sense and avoid stuff is the big one. Mm-hmm. So we actually have a project that's going to run, that's just started, it's going to run for another year, which is to drive our tractor from the workshop, which is a couple of hundred metres from the field, along a track to the field, basically. So it will drive itself along the track, turn a couple of corners and drive into the field. And that's going to be using the sort of same sense and avoid systems that they're putting onto the Google car and the Uber car, mm-hmm. and whatever. So we are very much systems integrators, is the way of describing what we do. Yeah. We don't develop things from scratch. We take things that exist and put them somewhere they weren't expected to be.
Yeah.
So, we took the stuff from a drone, put it in a tractor. Now we're going to take the stuff that makes a car drive along a road and put it on a tractor to make a tractor drive along the road, basically. So we hope that by this time next year that will certainly happen, that the tractor will drive itself to the field, avoiding anything that might appear.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the grand plan is to take our hands-free hectare to be a hands-free farm, which is kind of what I'm spending my summer working on, really, this plan for a hands-free farm. So And that's going to be multiple fields, multiple crops in a rotation, and, you know, fields as we find them. So rather than taking a field and sticking a square box in the middle, it'll be, here's a field, deal with it. So
how far away do you see that being, the hands-free farm? How far away is that?
So we're hoping to apply for funding for that this year.
Okay.
And then it'll kick off. If we apply for funding this year and that goes successfully, we'll be kicking off next year with the project, mm-hmm. not necessarily growing anything at that stage, but we'll be developing the machines and developing the farm. Bear in mind that we'll need a lot of infrastructure on this land that we take on. Yeah. We'll have to make sure that everything's in place. We've got good communication systems and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's crazy. It's not going to be easy, but nothing we've done is easy. So we like to keep setting difficult challenges. But, yeah, hopefully this time next year, I'd love to say that we'd all be working on our hands-free farm, basically.
You mentioned communication systems there, and I know you talked about the importance of that in your speech at the Oxford Farming Conference. Things like 5G technology. How important and how much of a hindrance is the lack of that to what you're doing?
So rural communication to us at the moment, as we're working, it doesn't affect. We have our own basically Wi-Fi system in field. Uh-huh. But going forward, if you want this stuff to be commercial, if you want to be able to pull into any field with a machine, program it and set it off it goes to do some farming. Yeah, it needs to be connected. Mm. It needs to have connection to it, so you can, watch its telemetry, know where it is, know it's not falling in the ditch, know that it's got seed on board, know it's not got any block coulters or whatever. All those things. That's what you realise when you're trying to replace a human. You suddenly realise all the things that a human does. So a human doesn't just drive a tractor up and down in straight lines, which is what I always flippantly say. And when I'm talking about this, I say, is the best use of a human to drive in straight lines on a tractor, or would they be better off, making agronomic decisions, making decisions mm-hmm. on the farm business, but obviously that's massively oversimplifying it, because they're not really driving in straight lines. They're driving straight lines, like you say. You're monitoring the seed, you're monitoring your coulters, you're monitoring, making sure nothing's broken, nothing's hanging off. So all of those things you then have to replicate with a person, with a machine, and that is going to require a huge amount of computing power. Mm-hmm. And the key is, if we can get good communication systems, we can put all of that computing power in a server somewhere, so the machines stay cheap. So with poor communications, you need all the computing power, all the cleverness needs to be held on the machine, and therefore the machine will be very expensive.
Yeah, okay.
And every machine will have to have a computer on it.
Yeah.
Essentially a supercomputer of sound.
Which makes it prohibitive, I guess.
Exactly. Mm. So if we can get communication systems to be good, you can keep the machines relatively dumb, but they can have lots of sensors, beam all the information back to a server. The server can crunch all that and send back any information it needs to. And computing on servers is infinitely cheaper.
Yeah.
So it's from that point of view, it's really important. But obviously, you send five machines out into a field to do some farming for you. You go back to the yard or go back to the office working some paperwork. You need to be able to get an alert if something happens as well. So yeah, we absolutely need decent communication. And so 5G promises that. There are multiple things that. So 5G is a technology that is yet to be found, but it has been defined. And one of the defining points is that it must have 100% coverage.
Yeah.
Now, my point that I made at Oxford is that is the one point that I think they'll all give up on, and they'll just claim that it's 5G without it.
Mm.
So, because if you're in a town or a city, which 90% of the population are or whatever, it doesn't matter. But for us people who want to use it for other things, the 100% communication is absolutely critical. 100% coverage is absolutely critical. So I'd like to bang on about it a bit, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure everyone listening will see where you're coming from, for sure. So, I mean, Harper Adams, they must bloody love you now. It's been amazing for the university itself, hasn't it?
Yeah. So as I say, at first I was, we made lots of people very nervous about this project.
Yeah.
We had lots of disapproving looks, but yeah, no, since then we can't do too much wrong, which is good.
Yeah.
So it's just been amazing. It's gone. The thing, you know, as I said at the start, the whole point of the project was to make a noise, move a conversation, make as much impact as we could, make people realize that farming clever and innovative, but it's just been way more successful than we could ever imagine. You know, I think the current count is 85 countries around the world. It's thousands of online articles written about us, YouTube views and whatever else. I think harvest coming up, I think we've got potentially got 4 film crews coming to film our harvest this year.
Wow.
And they're international. We've got that 3 of those are from America.
Yeah.
I think we've got a print journalist coming from Germany. So, properly international interest. It's just, absolutely way bigger than we ever could have imagined.
Do you have to just pinch yourself sometimes? Do you sometimes look at what you've done and think, wow, how did I do all this?
I don't know really. You don't really stop.
Yeah.
It sounds really bad, but you have to stop yourself getting annoyed with it. So at the moment I've got an inbox full of people saying, I've sent you 3 emails now, would you like to come and talk at my event? We have to realize that it won't last forever.
Yeah.
One day people won't want me to go and talk at their events anymore, and one day a film crew won't want to turn up and film what I do for a living. So whilst it lasts, we're just trying to enjoy it and trying to get the most out of it, really.
Yeah. And you've talked about inspiring young people and getting them into the industry. So something like this is playing a huge part in that, isn't it? A quote, something you'd written was, you wanted to show that it's an industry of cutting edge science and technology, not just twine, tweed and tractors. And I love that line, by the way. But I thought that was a really great way of putting it. And something like this it's really going to bring people into farming, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you think I'm a clever kid at school, I've got some ability. What do you think of as a career? You think engineering, you think of designing planes and designing cars.
Yeah.
Or if you think of IT, you think of designing, going and working for Google or, Amazon or someone like that, People don't think that agriculture needs those skill sets, but it really does. We're more and more data driven era. We need people with those data and analytical skills. We need people with those design robotic skills just as much as any other industry. We have this image that anyone involved with agriculture just spends their life up to the knees in mud, which is couldn't be further than the truth. You only have to sit in any tractor cab these days and there's 2 or 3 computer screens at the end of the day. So I think the thing is, talking to farmers, you're preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
They all know that. It's trying to get that to a wider audience. And that's what we've kind of been successful in the sense that, we've been on the local news, we've been in the newspaper, we've been on the national news, So I think the biggest one probably so far was the One Show. We've got, I didn't appear in that, but the One Show turned up and filmed Martin and Jonathan in the field talking about the system and put it on after Channing Tatum for 5 minutes.
That's prime time BBC TV, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And how many of those viewers never realised that tractors had GPS on them, let alone that. That's what I always say to people is, how good is the, you think you live in an advanced sector of society? How good's your GPS? And they go, knows where I am to a couple of meters, doesn't it? It's like, well, our GPS knows where we are to 2 centimeters.
Yeah,
we're doing clever stuff here. So, it's good. It's been good to try and get that message out there. Really.
Yeah, and social media's helped as well, hasn't it? And I know you're very sort of positive and strong on social media.
Yeah, that was basically where it all started. Mm. So yeah, we were going to, my little go-to line on this is the reason that people watch rocket launches is because they want to see the rocket explode. And that's why people are interested in going to space. That's my view on it anyway. You know, why do, you know, same reason that why do you watch a Formula One race? You watch a Formula One race because there's a chance that someone might crash.
Yeah.
You don't watch a, you know, perfect race where everyone just gets along fine. So, and you don't watch a rocket launch to see it just go into space every time, because that would be a bit boring. You watch for the bit of jeopardy. So we've used social media in the same sense. So by putting live videos on YouTube or live on Facebook or whatever, people watch because there's a chance our tractor is just about to go AWOL and drive through the fence. So they engage.
Yeah. You know?
So luckily, so far, it's never done that. It has gone wrong, you know. We took the combine to cereals. We demonstrated it in front of, I guess it was about 150, 200 people, mm-hmm. 4 times. And the first time it went completely wrong. It was brilliant. You know, I'm stood in the ring. John and Martin have set the machine up. Click go. Off it goes. I've got a microphone in my hand. And the combine just drove off completely randomly towards the crowd. And we had to stop it. And, you know, but... And I had to think of something to say a bit sharpish as to come up with an excuse as to why it just went wrong.
Yeah.
But we don't hide any of those mistakes. No. The whole point is that happens, but hopefully that might inspire someone to go, well, I reckon I can solve that problem or whatever.
Exactly.
You know? So it's just purely about getting. So, yeah, I guess, sorry, going back to your question. Or your point is, we've used social media to grab some attention of some people, mm-hmm. and then some of those people happen to be journalists, who've then decided to write about us.
Yeah.
And that's how it really escalated. You know, the BBC turned up because they'd seen it on social media.
Yeah.
And then from seeing it on social media, they decided it was worth sending a film crew to see it, you know, basically.
Yeah.
And then once it was on the BBC, we were winning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what are your... some of your personal highlights, then, because you've won awards. I mean, Hans-Free Hector was mentioned in the DEFRA Health and Harmony case study. You've spoken at the Oxford Farming Conference, very prestigious thing. What are your personal highlights of it?
You've probably named them, really. I mean, the speaking at Oxford is just the thing that I don't think I ever expected.
Yeah.
Being an engineer, I say I'm very passionate about agriculture, but I never expected to get that platform, being a very ag platform, if you get me. And getting it at the age of 27 was quite good. My mother-in-law spoke at Oxford, but she spoke at Oxford when she was 50, and I spoke at it when I was 27. So that was a good win that day.
For anyone listening to this, do have a look on the Oxford Farming Conference channel on YouTube and look at your speech, because it was very good. And also, you were best dressed man at the conference, in my opinion.
And you'll notice that despite me bashing tweed, I wear quite a lot of it myself. So that was amazing. Being asked, so as I say, I had this sort of, when I came out of uni, I had this change the world chip on my shoulder. So being asked to write a piece to go into the DEFRA paper, that was quite a good day, you know, having to write the thing that then ended up in a piece of government literature. That felt quite good.
Yeah.
You know, it's opened, I mean, it literally opened doors. Me and John have been to Buckingham Palace. We've been to the House of Lords. It's just been amazing. The last 18 months just been absolutely amazing, really.
Yeah.
Okay. A month ago, we won the BBC Food and Farming Awards. Mm-hmm. We won an award at that. And again, essentially, it's called the BBC Food and Farming Awards, but it's kind of just the BBC Food Awards. And we didn't really think that they were going to give it to us, and they read out our name, and we all sort of looked at each other in disbelief. it's just been amazing, really. I say more than we could have ever expected. We set out to try and make it some impact, but it's just gone mental.
Where do you see all this in 10, 20 years time? I mean, it's just the technology. A few years ago, you'd have said these kind of things. It was sort of 2040, 2050, but now it just feels so tantalizingly close to being the norm on British farms, doesn't it? I mean, where do you see it going?
Yeah, I mean, again, that was the whole point, is when I spoke about agrobotics, you hit the nail on the head. People would respond with, yeah, that'll happen by 2050, won't it? And my belief was always that it should happen in the next 10 years. And I guess this was a couple of years ago. So now in the next 8 years, by the mid-2020s, you know, we should be there. And I hope, and I still think that, you know, mid-2020s, you will see tractors, machines in a field driving themselves. It just will be normal. Or it will, maybe normal is the wrong word, but it will exist.
Yeah.
It will exist and it won't be a surprise to see it.
Yeah.
So, you know, whereas, if you walk to our field now, it's still quite shocking to see a tractor drive itself for the first couple of minutes.
Yeah.
I think in 2025, you will see that quite a lot. It won't be completely common. Not everyone will have it, but people will.
Mm.
And hopefully the fact that you've just said that to me shows that we've helped, I say, change people's perspectives. That's the sort of, what bit do you enjoy the most question you just asked me a minute ago, but you've kind of summed it up there, because people saying to me, oh, this is all going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing we've done. We've made people say that.
Yeah.
You know, a year ago, 2 years ago, people wouldn't have said what you just said, basically.
Yeah.
And now they do. And it's kind of because of our project.
Yeah. You've turned the skeptics into believers, I guess.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. And there's still lots of issues. I mean, as you pointed out, where's your telegraph poles? Where's your oak tree?
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of errors. You know, if you've got a small machine, it's got a small drill on the back.
Mm-hmm.
I now have to fill it up 10 times a day.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm going out to it to fill it up 10 times a day, I may as well be sat on the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. So, but all of those sort of cutting points, they're just more challenges. They're just more problems to solve, if you ask me. You know, that's just more fun to be had, really.
Yeah.
for somebody.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, that's, that's a good way of putting it. All right, then. I'm going to end it with a quick quiz, because I've probably kept you long enough.
Yep.
All right.
No, I've probably kept you. I do ramble on.
No, not at all.
Any of my students would say.
That's the mark of a good lecturer, isn't it? I'm sure. It's, right, okay. My hard-hitting final questions. Are you ready for this? All-time favourite song. What is it?
I've written down 505 by the Arctic Monkeys.
Ah, okay.
Which is off of their Favourite Worst Nightmares album. It's good. They used to end their live shows with it. It's just, I don't really know why I like it. It's got some lyrics that, unless you really, really, really listen to them, you never work out what they mean, but it's just good.
Yeah, very cool choice.
It's good, and it makes you want to dance.
Yeah, well, that's all the best songs make you want to dance. If you could instantly download a skill or a talent to your brain, what would you go for? So mine, for example, would be playing the piano. I wish I could just bang, play the piano. What would yours be?
Yeah, it would be an instrument for me as well. Yeah, not copying you, but it is the same thing. I have never learnt an instrument yet. So probably I'd say the guitar, but guitar or piano, something that you find around the place. You know, I have friends that if they walk into a room with a piano or walk into a room with a guitar, can pick up and play it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that'd be awesome.
Such an enviable skill, that, isn't it? Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the best piece of advice that you give your students?
Question everything, and that's especially if they're listening to me giving a lecture. So, you know, but if I'm telling them how robots are going to take over the world, or, you know, trying to describe how a knife on a combine cuts through material and how we can calculate that, which is the sort of things I do, question it. Why is that the case, or is it all just lies?
Okay.
In terms of general life, I'm going to add another one. I'm going to steal your question. Just say yes to everything, because that's how I've got to where I am now. Keep saying yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I've been doing a bit of that, and it's getting me into all kinds of... I don't have a minute to myself anymore, but it's all good. Anyway, if you could go out for dinner with anyone from history, who would it be, and what would you ask them?
I'm going to be really cliched and say Harry Ferguson.
Okay.
Talk about stuff. Absolute legend of an agricultural engineer.
Absolutely.
And more than that, he was a bit of an interesting bloke. You know, he was the first person to fly a plane in Ireland. He built his own plane and flew it. So, you know, I bet he'd have a good anecdote or two.
Absolutely.
He'd probably beat my chopstick story. You
know. Yeah, I've read Harry Ferguson's biography on him, and yeah, he was quite an interesting guy, wasn't he? Great answer. Okay, and lastly, then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
I'm going to say it's probably not the best to a non-farmer, but Ben Taylor Davis, he's an agronomist.
Okay.
Who his handle's BenTD76. He's good. He likes real science, not just made up things. So if people put this is one field, it's great. This is another field, it's rubbish. He always just bashes them down in like you know Be more specific, you know, what are all the confounding variables? Kind of comes back to my question, everything answer.
Yeah.
He's very good at picking through what is science and what's just, you know, luck, essentially, which is really important in agriculture. Too often decisions are made on things that aren't really viably backed up. You know, it's just gut instinct.
Yeah.
So, good person at getting through to the truth.
Okay, Ben TD76. Right, I'll follow him. Okay, Kit, this has been fascinating. Really, really, really excited to see where you take Hands Free Hector over the next few years.
Well, yeah, no, cheers for asking me on. It's a bit different, and I hope I haven't been too rambling and boring.
No, not at all. It's been amazing. I might even try and get down and see it in action because I'm not very far away. So, yeah,
well, 14th of August. I shouldn't say that too much. I will end up with loads and loads of people watching the podcast. I mean, and it's not even a secret place. I think if you go on the website, you can really see where it is.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, come along and see it anytime you like.
Yeah, okay. All right, great to speak to you, Kit.
Perfect.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. If you're feeling generous, please give this a share or retweet on social media. If you feel like leaving the podcast a review on iTunes, that is always a huge help. The podcast has now been downloaded in 62 different countries, so I am giving a shout out to one every week. And this time it is the USA, second highest number of listeners from there. And many of them have become good friends through the power of social media. So hello to everyone across the Atlantic. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.